welcome back. Thank you for coming out to the second of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund programmings here at Comic-Con International San Diego. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that a lot of tremendous volunteers are giving their weekend to allow us to have these kinds of amazing conversations. So I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the volunteers at Comic-Con with a round of applause. Thank you. I'm Charles Brownstein, the Executive Director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. We are a nonprofit organization that protects the freedom to read, helps cartoonists and retailers when they face legal challenges and have to go to court. And our organization didn't exist when the challenges that we're going to talk about today occurred. And it's a real thrill to be able to be in the presence of these legendary artists who really spoke truth to power in the underground comics movement. I'd like to just briefly go down the stage and ask our panelists to briefly introduce themselves, and I'll set up a little bit of the legal context, and then we'll have our discussion. So, Robert, if you could please say a few words.
Well, my name's Robert Williams, and I was a participant in the underground comic book world for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, starting like in late 68.
My name is Joyce Farmer. I'm also early underground, but not quite 50 years. And I've never quit doing it, but because of the censorship, I had my fingers chopped off for quite a few years. But I'm back to it. Ask me later.
Ron Turner, I publish these wonderful people, and I've been doing that for almost 50 years.
Thank you. There's a great Spain Rodriguez quote. Spain, of course, is the visionary creator of Trash Man and other really significant and subversive comics. Thank you. He said, "When they suppressed the EC comics, I could see that any idea that there was freedom, it was a farce. Growing up in America, we were told that we have certain freedoms. You heard a lot about this, especially growing up during World War II. We had this propaganda about America standing for freedom. They could never suppress the vault of horror. It was America. You become a teenager, hey, wake up, kid. The police will tell you outright, you have no rights." And so there was this whole period of moral panic in the 1950s where the comic books were driven into just being completely puerile material as a result of the Comics Code Authority being created after the moral panic that we discussed in our previous panel. The Comics Code Authority was developed as a way to assure parents and other guardians of youth that their children would not encounter any challenging ideas, and if they were really good, any ideas at all in the contents of the comics that they would be looking at. And this stamp of approval is what Spain was talking about when he said, you know, they can't take away the vault of horror. Well, they did. But in the mid-1960s, you started to see a generation of cartoonists that were inspired by the comic book art form that didn't really want to play ball in the ballpark of making comic books about cosmic monkeys, you know, flying around with Superman or whatever stupid and silly thing, you know, they saw. Because, you know, hey, you grew up on the EC comics, you grew up in the world, you know, the world is changing. You don't want to do that stuff. You want to talk about what's around you. And so in Texas, you started to see Jack Jackson and Gilbert Shelton make their comics, so God knows the earliest or one of the earliest. Wonder Warthog is another. Over in Berkeley, out of the free speech movement, came Joel Beck's Lenny of Laredo. While in the Midwest, Jay Lynch and Skip Williamson were doing the Chicago Mirror and Bijou Funnies. Later you would see Dennis Kitchen's Crop Comics and later Kitchen Sink come out of that area. Over in New York, the underground newspapers had spun off a generation of underground comics, included Spade, Von Bode, Trina Robbins, and many others, through the East Village Other, or the Evo as it was called, and the publication Gothic Blimp Works. But really, the underground movement is credited as really coalescing around Robert Crumb, who moved from Cleveland to San Francisco in the Summer of Love and sold Zap Comics purportedly out of a baby carriage in the Haight-Ashbury area. And Zap was the comic that, you know, really drove everybody together. So with that brief setup, I would just like to get a brief sense from the panel about what your perception of the movement was before joining it and what it was that you saw that that made you want to be part of it.
Well, that's a good question, a real good question. One element you did miss was the psychedelic poster movement, which was really aiming toward comics.
How do you mean that?
Well, there was a Family Dog Rick Griffin cartoon poster. Mm-hmm. It was made up of panels. And all the psychedelic poster artists that I knew were EC followers and saw Dr. Wortham's promotion to clamp down and try to bring an end to what they thought was juvenile delinquency. But I think there's a lot of older people in this room, and that's kind of unfortunate, but we couldn't drag in some young people and under duress to hear all this. But if you had an understanding of what the United States of America was like in the 50s and in the 60s, well, there was a number of things that led up to underground comics. And one of them was the drug culture. And the drug culture, it was very, very powerful before the Vietnam War. But it wasn't like a hippie, happy flower thing. It was growing by leaps and bounds, and I was like part and parcel of it. My first exposure to the drug culture was in the late 50s when I had a short stint in the carnival, and I'd come face to face with an enormous amount of drug use. Another thing was a freedom of girly magazines. I'm hesitant to say pornography, but I guess that's a fact. The United States in the early 60s was really an inhibited place to be. And the war in Vietnam just ignited everything. The drug culture would really solidified before the Vietnam War, and it had got so developed that it developed a language, an underground language called carny talk. And when I come out to California in 63, they were even using carny talk on the rock and roll stations. And what it was it was like a drug language, like pig Latin, where they would put a Z in every syllable. So like if I said, like, fuck you, it'd be fiazuk yizu. So you could develop that language really fast, like lightning. It just sounded like a beehive. And this was like part and parcel of this drug culture that was spreading all through the United States. And then the code word to identify other people who took drugs was the good people. The good people was like the keynote. So another factor that was happening in the United States in the late 50s, especially the late 50s, was like a bogus form of suburban beatnik life. That where these coffee shops were popping up all over the United States in the late 50s and early 60s, and they were attracted, especially around colleges. And you had these young people who would go into a beatnik coffee house, and they'd read poetry, and everyone would sit on the floor, and they'd paint the walls black, and there'd be fishnets hanging in the ceiling with glass floating bobs up in there, and it was and playing progressive jazz, you know. So you had like the reminiscences of progressive jazz and abstract expressionism. You had like this real solid bohemian, well, kind of a pseudo-bohemian culture that really permeated through suburban America. Like as a little kid, I was finding people's parents that were swingers and stuff. It was like blowing my mind in 1959. And, you know, the kids said, "Well, come home with us." And I come home, and this Ozzie and Harriet family. All of a sudden, dad's gone, and mom's got a couple of lovers, and she's wearing black leotards, and the walls are painted black, and everybody's sitting on the floor, and everyone's like these pseudo-libertines. And they'd seen movies like Bell Book and Candle and the Beat Generation and stuff. So the actual connection from the true beatniks, you know, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and stuff, was like really kind of an insignificant thing. But this trend was like really established on colleges and everything. It didn't go over big in the Deep South. The Deep South really, like, in Montgomery and Atlanta, places like that, they'd have these coffee houses, and then gangs, white gangs, would just go in there and beat the beatniks up and throw them out. But anyway, this was part and parcel of this drug culture that was coming up. It was like fairly substantial. And if there was not a Vietnam War, it may have taken maybe 6 or 8 years for that drug culture to reach an ignition point like it did during the Vietnam War. But the point I'm making is all the elements that made the underground comics were all in place. When I was doing some illustration work while I was an underground cartoonist in the late 60s and early 70s, I applied some work to We Magazine, and they sent the work back. And they said, well, we can't accept this. And they said, well, the reason we can't accept this is that we don't know what to do with underground art. We don't know what to do with underground comics. It's too much like art. So right away, I knew that there was a different situation there. Now, there was a very, very large dominating factor of leftists and communists that were involved in the formation of the underground. Spain Rodriguez was a very close friend of mine. Was not only a communist, but he was a Stalinist. You know, I mean, he was like a radical Stalinist. We had enormous arguments about that. But the social structures were all falling into place. But, if a social anthropologist looked at it in like 1967 or 68 and wanted to define it, to say, well, you've got these this loose bunch of bohemians, or you've got these anarchists, or these leftists. But what they left out is the prime thing about the people who was forming these underground comics is you had people with abstract minds. And this was what really intrigued me about the underground comics. It was the next step off psychedelic posters. Psychedelic posters were totally locked in and dependent on the rock music. But the underground comics were not. They were free-thinking avenues of expression and the ability to exercise your skills and extend your imaginations. And I'm just going on and on. So
I think though that you are developing the rest of the compasses on the map the rest of the points on the compass rather of. What defined underground comics? We're here at a comic book convention, so a lot of people think about the context of the history of comics, but I think it's much more important to think about underground comics in the history of the culture, and you're identifying that this really bubbled up to speak to how America was changing and how you generationally were taking charge of that. So Joyce and Ron, you know, could you speak to where you were in the respective culture and what you were saying with the work, and then we're going to get into how law enforcement attempted to crack down on it. So whichever would like to go first, please.
I'd like Ron to go first because I want to come in with personal after that.
Okay.
I guess I'm first. That's a little rather tiny question, Charles. Thank you. So where were we at? It definitely was a changing culture. I mean, it was like you sift for sand, you know, you start with the bigger gratings, and you put rocks in, and you keep shifting it down the street. It seemed like every year some new revelation would hit you, or some new movement would happen, and you'd say, where was I before? Why didn't I see this? Everything was kind of unfolding to you. I think there was a marriage, not only of the poster art at the time, but also the beatnik world had to come into things. And I like to think of this, I finally uncovered how Don Donahue, who had gone to Catholic high school in San Francisco, gone to UC Berkeley, and he ran into this guy, Charles Plimel, who was a beatnik poet. Charles is still alive in his 90s, he and his wife Pam. And Allen Ginsberg told me he gave Plimel a press that he got from a National Arts Grant, and on that press, Plimel was printing broadsides of poetry to hang up around San Francisco. And he and Donahue had become friends from poetry readings, and they both talked about a underground newspaper called Yarrow Stocks that came out of Philadelphia, in which there was a cartoonist. They said, oh, wouldn't we really love to publish this guy, put some images, Robert Crumb. Well, Crump came to San Francisco with his wife, then wife Dana, and they had a kid. And They all got, Donahue met them at a party, and they all got together over at my old address, 2180 Bryant, where the press was, and they put it up for Zap Comics. The reason that there's a Zap Zero and then a Zap One, they printed up Zap One, was that the cartoon art was missing or stolen or whatever. It eventually resurfaced, but to keep it in chronological order, even though Zap Two was out by that time, they published it as Zap Zero. So there was a blending of the, there was a baton pass of the beatnik world into the underground comics world. But also there were people like Greg Irons and Rick Griffin, who were all poster artists, and I got to meet them because one of the letterers for those things, Randy Tootin, lived next to me in 69, and after a hard day of being chased by cops in San Francisco State, they had 2,000 cops on campus every day, I come home and get stoned and play a game of chess with Randy, and I got to meet all these poster artists, and they were very much into psychedelics, and the whole culmination of that was eventually these, I got introduced to the comic things and we started to blend in. The ecology, you know, socially causes seemed to be a perfect match in my mind for social propaganda and basically just propaganda for the, what we call the movement. And the movement is what was driving me mostly, trying to right the ills, charging at windmills with the lance of a cartoonist's pen. So that's, I don't know if I got anywhere near where you were going for it, but that's how.
Well, I think it is really important that, you know, the baton pass that you both are talking about and the general culture gave us a lot of context. And Joyce, you had a personal interjection.
Well, I thought it might be interesting from my point of view with these generalities setting up what the stage. I'm older than many people in the room, and I was born in late 1938, which means I'm turning 80 at the end of this year. I married at the age of 19, and that would have been whatever you can do the math, and had a child, and had this, I had gone to Art Center School, and my husband had too, so we were coming out of Art Center School. But everything was very rigid back in the late 50s, and we had a child, and I was pregnant accidentally almost as soon as I married, and you just simply, back then, you went ahead and had the child and dealt with the realities. And in my younger life, before I married, my mother had died when I was 11, and my dad left around the house for me to read The Coming of Age in Samoa, and perhaps From Here to Eternity. He didn't have anybody to play the mom to teach me things, so he was leaving me these books. And I started getting the idea that there was a very big world out there. I didn't have the cultural connections you're talking about. But as my life and my early married life went on, which was entirely dealing with raising a baby and cooking dinner and working at an insurance company, God help me, I later divorced my husband. One of the things that caused me to divorce him was saying, I went out and I got a driver's license by saving household money. And I got this driver's license. I was 24 years old. And I brought the license home and I said, "Look, honey." And he said, "Well, that's the end of our marriage." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you won't need me anymore." And this is giving Joyce ideas. And I went out and got a job, and I did all kinds of things with that car. It was just a wonderful experience to be able to drive. And then I didn't need him anymore. He was right. Got a divorce. Came back to California, where I'd been born and raised in Los Angeles, where I'd also gone to those coffee shops, etc., when I was quite young, probably underage for a lot of them. And after a period of time, I moved to Laguna Beach. I started meeting people who were very good thinkers, very solid thinkers, and it was very interesting to be around creative people. And I, somewhere along the line, met Lynn Chevley, who owned the Fahrenheit 451 bookstore, which is one of the problems with our getting nearly arrested. Other people were arrested in place of us. But she had the idea of doing this comic book, and we started working on it, and all of my frustrations and I don't know if I was angry or if I was just felt like life was unfair in that the guys got the jobs and the interesting things and everything I wanted to do that was interesting, I really couldn't because I had to make dinner that night and raise a kid and go to work at the insurance company. I can't tell you, I was probably deeply angry, but I didn't know that because all women were deeply angry back then, pretty much. And that's how I got started. And I think it's a very important background because all of us are embedded in the culture when we're growing up, and we have to go somewhere with it. And to some degree, the people in the underground movement were just happening at the right moment, at the right place. I remember when we first did our Tits and Clits, the artwork was so bad. And I thought, who would buy this bad artwork? And Ron Turner would buy it. That was
beyond Ron, I think that there was we've established a really wonderful context through which this comes in. Amy Wright, could I borrow you for a moment, please? Could you go to the stage? So as the underground movement progressed, as the cultures that you're describing advanced, it didn't take long. I'm going to ask if you want that. It didn't take long for law enforcement to be interested in these sorts of expressions. It didn't take long for law enforcement to be concerned with the sorts of ideas that were going on in these comics. And so you began to see obscenity bus in, this is an excerpt from a San Francisco Chronicle article, November 15, 1968, at Bus at Moe's, where police walked into the shop and dragged away 47 copies of a magazine with an off-color title, which was Snatch, 74 copies of Zap Comics number 2, one copy of The Scum Manifesto, several copies of My Fellow Americans by Ron Cobb, and held him on $500 bail. Amy's going to walk around this poster. If you just move up the aisle, it'd be great. This is the actual exhibition poster from the new comics and exhibition at the Phoenix Gallery, art from, I believe, Zap number 4 from the looks of it. So there was this whole sense that, as Bill Griffith said in the 2012 symposium, when I did underground comics, you could get busted for it. You could actually get arrested. Not the cartoonists, but the distributors, the bookstore clerks. We, the cartoonists, were untouched but chilled by the whole things. So I'd like to ask our panelists, what was your sense of how law enforcement was cracking down on this material, and what vulnerability did you feel about this?
Okay. You've investigated this thing pretty tightly, but I might be able to add something to it. My first contradiction toward you was that it wasn't just the cops started getting interested in it. The police were always interested in it since time immemorial. I remember as a very young child with the 8-page Bibles, the Tijuana Bibles, those were a crime. Photographic pornography was a crime. Leftist literature was under suspicion. When I remember we spent the Christmas of 1969 at the Zap artist at Robert Crumb's place out in Potter Valley. And we were very, very concerned at this time because we were under the impression that they were trying to reinstitute the internment camps for dissidents. Well, people don't understand about the Vietnam War. It was the United States supported the Vietnam War up to a point, and then the underground artists, especially the Zap artists, had stuck their neck out so far. I was working at Ed Roth's at the time. I was investigated by the FBI for working with Roth because he was tied in with the Hell's Angels, and they were looking at him for the RICO Act. I was a draft dodger. I had under suspicion there, and at Ross, an FBI agent come by every 2 weeks and had to talk to all of us. And then Zap Comics was a prime thing in the United States that had the FBI interest. There was a point there. All of us thought that there's going to, if the country swung any more to the right, they were going to start rounding up dissidents and they were going to sweep us up in this situation. So it was far more concerning than you would think it would be. We had no doubt that we're in a position that... was a high profile position that we're just like the anti-war demonstrators. They're going to start sweeping people up. We're in that mess with them. So there was a concern that, but fortunately, the United States swung to the left and was against the war. But there was a period there we were on the fence, and it was nick and tuck.
Now, Ron, you were actually in the Bay Area when the bust in Mose, the bust in Phoenix happened. So what was your exposure, and what's your recollection of how the police were investigating this war?
Well, it wasn't unexpected. You have to remember, there's also this area that we call Vice. And the whole thing with Vice is it's for people to go out and bust people that have no one who can defend them. They bust prostitutes, they bust, you know, it's all Vice. It's kind of doing the Lord's work in politics. And especially during election year, when you have candidates running, especially incumbent candidates like mayors and DAs and whatnot, they always go out and start making all the drug busts. You know, get the junkies, get the whores, get the pornographers, and clean it up. And it makes headlines. And supposedly in society, you, because it's a moral issue, you don't have any defense for that. You violated morals, and therefore, and it's our morals. We're the owners of the moral police. So the Vice Squad were always the ones that came after the comic thing. So that's I simply thought at the time it was simply the Vice coming after it. My dad had, we had movie theaters when I grew up and film and whatnot. My dad had a little business on the side where he sold off what they called Bloom movies or whatever to people, or rented them out. So even the local sheriff's department came to the house to watch movies premiere for their smokers. And I remember one time when I was about 7 or 8, my dad says, get the French doors in the back of this little tiny house we lived in. And I opened them up, and he ran out with a sack and immediately went between the peach trees and began digging a hole. He threw it through the contents of the bag in the hole, covered it up, went back out, and ran and answered the door. He was sweating. He was in his wife beater shirt, you know, and he said, yeah, what is it? And it was a couple of FBI guys. Oh, Mr. Turner, I understand you got some films here. No, he knows. There's a place. I don't have anything. And it was just odd, but I remember that this almost this, not exactly the same people, but the same kind of people came by to rent the shit for their smokers that they had. So it was such a double standard society, and anybody could see through it.
Hey, Ron, you've got a good double standard story about one of, there were a lot of unsuccessful busts that happened. There was one successful one we're going to talk about in a minute, but it's a Los Angeles story involving a pungently named comic that maybe you can tell us about.
Well, this is because of Robert Williams. This all happened. As I understand the story, and please correct me after I've done speaking. The cartoonists got upset about being called dirty comic creators. So they kind of like put a stiff upper lip to it all and drew their what they said was really a dirty comic. I think we'll show them what a dirty comic is, and they drew Felch comics. Now, Felch, for those who don't know what that means, is the oral retrieval of semen from someone else's anus.
Filthy.
Oh, I know. Sorry, I hope you had your lunch.
You get set it poetically.
And anyway, so George DiCaprio, the father of Leonardo, who grew up with cases of pork comics by S. Clay Wilson holding up his beds, was distributing down in L.A. and around, and in Long Beach, a store got busted, and they thought they really had this guy. And that's what they would go after. They'd go after the clerks and whatnot, people that had, you know, they had no arm in the boxing match. They were just, you know, there, and they got busted, and they'd be easily agree to a plea deal to get out of it because nobody's going to help them. And so they went in, they had a whole box full of like 100 different underground comics, and they read it off to the judge and the titles and whatnot. So the judge heard all this. He says, bring me the Felch up here. I want to see the Felch. And they went into their box, and they began looking. Felch was like a smaller comic, a snatch-sized comic. the guy, you know, started throwing comics out, and on the table they began stacking up, and they went through the entire comics, and the judge says, hurry up, I got gone all day, bring me the felch. And the Georges had attended the trial. I don't know, did you attend that trial, Robert?
Pardon?
Did you attend that trial?
Was that a fact? Was that a fact?
Yes, this is all fact. Did you
well, that you didn't tell it as poetically as I would have told it.
All right, let's let Ron say his piece.
Well, let Robert go.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off there. George DiCaprio was with the lawyer of the bookstore owner. And they were in the outside office of the judge's chambers. And the judge was in with the prosecutor. So they're going to go through this box, and the prosecutor's going to show him the most filthy thing in there. But apparently the box of comics had been beaten around the police station long enough, and some cop went through there and found that little fella. She says, they won't miss this one. So they go through the box, and they can't find the felch. So the judge and the prosecuting attorney are screaming out through the door, where's the felch? Where's the felch? They couldn't find it. They based their entire case on this one little dirty comic book, and so they just dismissed the case. But I don't mean to cheat you out of time there, but the one thing that was important was when Don Shanker had the FBI walk in on him at the print mint. And to say, well, you're going to go to prison with these comics. You're going to prison. And Don Shanker, within 24 hours, walked out of the print mint and turned the entire company over to the shipping and receiving young guy. It was a Mexican there named Bob Rita. So poor Bob Rita ends up with the whole print mint company. Don Shanker split. That's how scary things were. You remember that?
Yeah, but Bob was from Hawaii. He's Hawaiian.
Hey, Joyce, your bookstore was in that locality. It was in that area, the Orange County area, right?
Well, Long Beach and Orange County are.
Yeah, so the area where the Phelps trial was happening and ultimately got dismissed, you know, those are the kinds of cops that you were kind of snooping around when you were doing Abortion Eve. Do you have any, recollection of, what the climate was like legally for you guys?
Well, we knew it was getting dicey, but this is actually the first time I've ever heard the Phelps story or anything about this trial. I don't know how bad. We were in Orange County, and this is a million miles from San Francisco, as any San Franciscan will tell you. Generally, Laguna Beach is pretty liberal where we live, but Orange County itself has been traditionally very conservative, and we were carefully watching our area, but not this other. Of course, there was the bookstore bust in Laguna Beach, because the district. Do you want me to tell that?
Yeah, well, great.
Yeah, the district attorney of Orange County was a woman named Oretta, or one of the district attorneys, I guess, named Oretta Sears, and she had taken a case, I don't remember what, a theoretically pornographic movie up to the Supreme Court and won, what was that, Deep Throat? I don't know, I never saw these things. I'm coming out of UCI classics degree and my own little world and an art world, and I actually know artists and this kind of thing, and it just was out of my realm of knowledge to be paying too much attention to these things. Anyway, all of a sudden, the bookstore that we had been selling comics in was busted, and it turned out that it was busted because they were selling Leather Nun and Zaps and different things. And then it turns out that this Oretta Sears wanted us. And we didn't quite understand why or know it at the time, because we didn't realize we were breaking the law. And Oretta Sears had Orange County, they came to the bookstore to inspect what comics were being sold and buy samples of each comic. And to our great good luck, they bought the last sample of Tits and Clits in the store. And the idea was to take the district attorney and be able to get everybody down the line, the artists, the publisher, and the bookstore owner, all in one swoop, because Lynn had owned that bookstore. It had been sold later to some other people, the Wilsons. But they had the idea that they could get everything in one arrest, all these people just right down the line. And we were warned, we missed being arrested at that moment, but the bookstore owners were arrested in our place. They were both teachers, or he was a teacher and she was a housewife and a former Carmelite nun. And she was also 5 months pregnant when they were arrested. So they spent the night in jail, I guess, and bailed themselves out with a $500 bond. It was something that was not real expensive, but it was about to just blow up. We had produced a second copy. Tits and Clits was such a outrageous name that we couldn't sell it just anywhere. It was difficult. And so we changed the name to a milder name called Pandora's Box, and which those are rare now, of all things, after I dumped I don't know how many thousand. Anyway, I took Pandora's Box, which we had just published, Lynn and I, ourselves, not with Ron, and into the bookstore to sell them a bunch, and they said, get out, and get out right now. And we were busted for selling your other comics, or we were busted for selling the Undergrounds. They didn't get any of yours because they bought the last copy, and so there was no evidence to collect when they came to bust the owners.
What was the disposition of the case to get dismissed?
Finally, I called the ACLU, because you didn't exist.
Right.
Called the ACLU, and the ACLU basically said, comic books, not interested. And so I was whining and crying to the Laguna Beach Free Clinic, where I was a volunteer, and they called the ACLU, and they said, very interested. So they got involved. They got on the case of the bookstore owner, and they came to advise us. And one of their nice pieces of advice, which goes for everybody in this room, was if the ACLU gets involved in a censorship case with you, we are going to be on the ACLU side. We are not going to be on your side. It may end up okay for you, but you may get caught in this web and ground up, because we are fighting for freedom of speech and we don't really care what happens to you. That was a serious lesson there. And I had a state of California insurance license, so I was worried to have any conviction on my record. But anyway, about a year later, the ACLU plus whatever, they just dumped the whole thing. Just ended.
Yeah, and about that time, too, the Supreme Court would have decided the obscenity laws. And we have about 10 minutes left on the panel, and I'd like to get to the conviction that, you know, really stuck and made a big difference in everything. That's the Zappa before conviction in New York, where it was the state of New York versus Kirkpatrick, Martin, Dargis, Rose, and McCoy. But, you know, basically, I'm not going to run through all of the issues, but, you know, this was your first issue with Zap, right, Robert? So,
that's right.
You know, there was all of this climate. Was there premeditation about the material? Was there concern about arrest? What was your disposition as an artist putting this out, aware of the risks? And what was your point of view when you found that on the trial?
There is another point that really hasn't been consciously recognized here in discussing these comics. Underground comics were not made for the general public. They were made for an arcane audience that seeked them out. We weren't shoving them down people's throats. And we figured there is an intellectual group of people out there that favor free thought and imagination, storyline, whatnot. These books are for our generation. Hunt them up. Big companies were offering to put ads in Zap, and we turned them down. This was an underground material. It was arcane, you know.
They all said adults only.
Yeah, and it said adults only. But pornography, pornography was hand and fist with us at the same time.
Right.
As Zaps progressed and underground comics progressed, so did the pornography industry. Look, I don't mean to get off the subject here, but I think this is important that I bring this up. In Amsterdam in the late 60s, there was a publication called Suck. And this was put out by a fellow named Willem de Ridder. I don't know if you've ever heard of Willem de Ridder. But he was a Dutchman that believed in absolutely free anything. And he came to the United States with this Suck, and it was like mind-blowing, because it's just like any program you could imagine is in this thing. And it was like a revolutionary situation. So Crumb got interested in it, and a lot of underground artists got interested in it, and they were also interested in using a lot of stuff out of Zap and whatnot. And there was kind of an exchange there of underground art that turned up in these publications. So when Willem de Ridder came to this country, he started another magazine called Finger. And he was in cahoots with the L.A. Star, which was a swinger newspaper and tabloid. So this, since Willem de Ridder come in with this L.A. Star, things got really wild. I mean, wide open. Child sex and eating feces, and you can't think. There was like no limits to it right there on these papers. So anyway, they got me to do a logo for them. And there's a fellow, a very important fellow named Dan O'Bannon. It was one of the guys that put together, it was one of the key guys that put together the Alien. He was a very important person in Hollywood. Well, he was a remarkable draftsman, and he did these cartoons of children having sex with adults in this thing, and the FBI moved in on this thing. Because I did logos, they moved in on me. The FBI went over and arrested Dan O'Bannon and scared him so badly that he had a mental breakdown. He got off of it. And I was getting phone calls from like 12-year-old girls wanting to have sex with me, trying to set me up. And it was just, this was a whole thing that sprung off of the underground comics.
Well, that's just that's the type of, so this is the context, and this is the case, and this is actually Robert's contribution to it, which the judge in his conviction had rejected the argument that the material is not obscene because it is speaking to a sophisticated audience. He regarded himself as a moral arbiter for the common person, not the sophisticated person that can understand this material. So there's a few of the others that were in there. In fact, on Robert's work, he dissed you, Robert. He said, the supreme constellation of Dormus and Toria, the next cartoon on four pages by artist Robert Williams, in quotes, what a jerk, says nothing and means less except to show a woman's vaginal area, which I don't know if that's what you see there. There's a lot more going on. So the point is, this was the conviction. This was in New York City, the most liberal of liberal communities. So this really sent shockwaves. We've really got to start wrapping up, but Ron, as a publisher, like, how did this change everything, this conviction in New York?
Didn't do anything for me.
Yeah? Because you were local? You weren't scared about us?
We were national. What it did do, it completely changed the comic community in New York, because it was busted by, they had this second Sunday event in New York, a little comic convention done by a guy named Phil Suling, who
right.
was a high school teacher. And Phil was busted because the comic came out of somebody was selling it at the event. As a result, he lost his teaching job, and in doing so, set up a Seagate Distribution, which became the first distributor. Mike Friedrich and a few other people had gone back to New York to Marvel and said, look, the Underground sell their comic books this way. You know, one way they sell it off, 60 off to a distributor. And Marvel and DC said, well, we sell it, 30 off to stores and we give them returns. He says, yeah, but that's a lot of waste. You know, why not sell it one way? And so that's how Marvel and DC began doing their direct market. And that changed the entire comic industry as a result of that bust.
Yep, and that is, unfortunately, that is another story. We're getting the high sign that we need to start wrapping. So I would like to just bring it all home that, this is a period of time where people making their art... Go ahead.
Just one other thing. It was like most of the comics, back then there weren't comic book stores. That also started, comic book stores starting to happen. We had like two or three in the country when we started publishing comics. And how did we sell them? We sold them to where the print mint had set up the poster business. They piggybacked comic books out to the head shops and places that sold posters. And so most of our accounts around the country, there were up to maybe 30,000 head shops in the United States. And a lot of them sold them because they were hip head comics. They were people who like Stone liked to read this stuff. And most of the people who owned head shops were not real intellectual giants. And, you know, they didn't look after this, the, you know, next wave of intellectualism or whatever. But they knew that people would part money for them. And they carried them. And then, so the government went after head shops for paraphernalia things. And as soon as they did that, they began bringing in comics and began busting head shops for comics. And then all the comic people, they we were just considered throw us under the bus, basically, because they were more worried about their bombs than they were their comics. But comic book stores then started carrying them.
So I think that's a really important point, and that really leads to the transition. And as we wrap up our panel, I think it's important to note that, you know, since the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund was started in 86, we've been able to really fight back this trend that you saw of retailers being targeted and prosecuted for selling this work. But it's not something we can take for granted. So as participants that were working in a time of severe persecution, where that doesn't really happen today, could you please give me one sentence about the value of standing up for free speech that you want younger audiences to take away with them today, and why we can't grow complacent about this stuff?
I can give one sentence. First of all, you have to get a grip, and you have to do what you feel is right. I had my MO changed with comics, but you can work around it. I didn't do anything controversial for a long, long time, but this year I've just finished a story and sold it to Pennsylvania Press called "Do Menopausal Women Even Get Horny?"
We look forward to seeing that. Robert, do you have Ron, because Robert, you always get the best last word. Ron, do you have a one-sentence, sorry to throw you under the bus, buddy. Do you have a one-sentence about why we need to stand up for free expression today?
My late friend Warren Hinkle, who had Ramparts magazine and was probably outstanding in many areas of anti-censorship. And, on his tombstone, he had one word put on his tombstone: fuck him.
Bring us home on why free speech matters, Robert.
Well, repression's coming again. Yeah, it's going to come again. It's going to be fun to watch how the new generation is going to deal with it. I wish I'd be around to see this. But, it's something that has to always be fought for. It's going to be fun to watch it be fought back. You look at what's happening politically, and you can see that we're slipping. We're slipping back into the dark ages, and so it's repeating itself. And then when that happens, it's going to generate a lot of new energy, and all the people in this room will be part of the old situation that would set an example for the young people. So things will work out.
Joyce, you've got
one tiny thing. I see a lot of older people in this room. A lot of you are probably artists. And all I can say about myself and maybe about you is do what you want, because are they going to take away your Social Security?
All right. Thank you very much.
The older you are, the more you can...